Okay, we're recording.
Wow, you didn't give us a 10-second warning.
Well, the 10 seconds was one from when I said it.
Okay. All right, we're recording.
Yes.
Hey everyone, and welcome to At the Letters for April the 17th, 2025. I am Ben Nicholson-Smith here with you, along with Arden Zwelling on this episode of ATL, produced, as always, by Christian Ryan. Arden, how are you doing today on this Blue Jays off day?
I'm all right. It doesn't feel like we get too many of these early in the year, so we'll take it.
Yeah, exactly. They are pretty rare. It's been a while since the Blue Jays had one. Since their last off day, they have been on a three-city road trip on which they went 4-5 with one rain delay. Then they came back home, took 2 of 3 from Atlanta, including some pretty big wins against Spencer Schwellenbach and Spencer Strider. Really, I mean, some elite pitching. I know Strider's not fully ramped up and fully at his peak form, but still a pretty encouraging series win, including Vlad Jr. hitting his first home run of the season, his first home run since signing that $500 million extension.
Guerrero high and deep to left field, and there it is. His first home run of the 2025 season. Boy, is that going to feel good for him as he launches it out to left to give the Blue Jays a 2-0 lead.
So the Jays are 11-8 right now. Big picture, where are you at with this team?
Man, I would not have even known that, the 11-8 figure.
Really?
Like, I don't know where anybody's at. I know, like, ostensibly that the Jays are over 500.
Yes.
But I couldn't tell you, like, where they're at in the AL East. I couldn't tell you, like, the run differential or anything. Like, I don't even look at it until May, June, honestly.
Fair. Yeah, they are second place in the American League East, a half game behind the Yankees. So now you know.
Now I know. And you know what? I did actually forget about the sort of unintended off day that we each had in Baltimore, where we got to sit yes. around in Baltimore while it poured rain outside, which is an interesting way to spend the day. So I guess we have had an off day recently. Yeah, you know, they've been facing some good pitching. I think Strider isn't quite Strider yet, which is to be expected. His first big league start comes at Rogers Center, and obviously he had a minor league ramp up before then, but you could tell, like, the secondary stuff wasn't quite as crisp, and the velo isn't where it is when he's at his best, and that's to be expected. Everyone who I've talked to coming off of major elbow surgery has said that, yeah, it's going to be a process of several months from when you actually get back on the mound to when you're feeling like yourself again, and it could be longer or shorter for certain guys. So that wasn't exactly peak Strider that they saw there. Schwellenbach is definitely impressive. Like, you know, the very, very good heaters, fastball and, the slider pretty good as well. A lot of elo there. So not an easy matchup. And, the Blue Jays beat both of them. So, hey, that's kind of what the Jays have been doing. They have been sort of winning in spite of themselves, winning in spite of the odds, and are in my brain somewhere in a sort of murky, fuzzy, not exactly clear place above 500.
Yeah, I think that's a fair place to put them. And they are in good company when it comes to their standing, hovering around the 500 mark. There are a lot of teams in the American League that are trying to create some separation. And it's still going to be hard for the Blue Jays the rest of this month because they're facing the Mariners and their great pitching. Houston, that's a good team. Then Yankees and Red Sox to close out the month. So as we knew, going into this first stretch of the season, it was not going to be easy, and it hasn't been easy. But for them to be 11-8 right now, that gives them just a tiny, tiny bit of a buffer where they really have a good shot to finish the first month of the season at or a little bit above 500, despite playing some really tough opposition, some of the toughest schedule that you'll find in Major League Baseball. So I think they're on a good track right now, and they've got some questions. We'll get to those questions on the pitching staff. We'll get to the questions about the home run production here. But I actually think for them to be at this point, when they have one home run from Vlad and Bo combined, 3 from Vlad, Bo, and Santander combined, I actually think they're in a good spot.
Yeah, just finish like at or a little bit above 500 every month of the season, and you're a playoff team. You don't have to win 110 games to reach the postseason. You might only need to win 88 or 89. Obviously, you prefer to win your division, but despite the start that the Blue Jays are off to, and despite the fact that I've just learned that they're in second place in the American League East, I don't expect them to win this division. So really, for them, it's like get to somewhere a little bit above 90 games, and you're going to feel good, and you're going to go into a wild card series, and then we're going to roll the dice a few times.
Yeah, it's weird, though, this division. Like, I actually think Baltimore, which is now in last place, and we saw them over the weekend in Baltimore, I think they might be the favorite to win this division, at least in my mind. I think the Red Sox are a team to be reckoned with. But the Yankees, when I look at their questions on the pitching side and the injuries that they've had, I think they're going to have some real struggles to just find enough quality pitching. Baltimore certainly has enough bats that they could actually even go out and trade for starting pitching. Like, they should be a player for Alcantara at the trade deadline. Anyone else who kind of pops and is available. I think that when Grayson Rodriguez and Zach Eflin get back, then they can have a pretty good pitching staff. But to your point, I certainly wouldn't say the Blue Jays are the favorites by any stretch. They're going to be fighting uphill if they want to have any prayer of winning this division. And I'm not expecting them to win the American League East. But some of their opposition has actually been kind of weakened relative to what we thought they might be.
Yeah, I mean, Rodon and Fried is still a pretty good starting point for the Yankees. You mix in Clark Schmidt, who just came back, and people kind of forget that he was actually pretty good last year. I'm not sure entirely when Luis Gil is supposed to be back, but that's your defending rookie of the year. And then Marcus Stroman, whenever he's over what he's going through right now, which I believe is just inflammation, so it can't be too long that he's out, that's pretty capable as a number five. Like, if we're lining him up as the Yankees five and we're lining Easton Lucas up as the Blue Jays five, I'm probably taking the Stroman side of that equation.
Stro. It's been too long since we've spent much time talking about Stro on At the Letters, but I'm sure many an episode was dedicated to his production at one point. Let's focus on Easton Lucas instead here, because with Max Scherzer still sidelined, still trying to work his way back, this is going to be an extended chance for Easton Lucas to potentially get some run in this rotation. John Schneider saying the other day that he expects that to be Easton Lucas's spot for the time being. They're certainly not seeing a lot of upward pressure from Jake Bloss. Eric Lauer, maybe a tiny bit of, you know, I don't want to say pressure, but he's an alternative if they want one. But really, this is Easton Lucas's opportunity. And as we saw on Monday, there is downside too. I mean, he had a couple really good starts to get things going, and full credit to him, but this is kind of an extra starter who was on waivers. We probably shouldn't forget about that when we're establishing what to expect out of him.
Yeah, I think it's clear from watching him pitch that he's got good stuff. Like, he's got a fastball he can survive on. He's got a really good slider. His changeup can be a weapon for him when he's locating it. The issue for him against the Braves was he just wasn't locating his secondary stuff, particularly the changeup. Like, he just didn't have that pitch at all to his arm side. So, you know, everything was kind of working glove side for him, and the slider command was inconsistent. So I think that the Braves were able to basically eliminate anything that was less than fastball speed, and were able to eliminate anything to his arm side and kind of say, yeah, just like let that go and look for something coming in. And I think that's what Austin Riley did, is he just kind of eliminated the outer half of the plate, look for pitches coming in. And you look at the location of the two pitches that he hit out. To me, if I'm reverse engineering what his approach was there, that's what I think was happening. So for Lucas, really, it is just going to be so important for him to command that secondary stuff, because it's not like his fastball, he can get by on it, but it's not like an overpowering fastball. Like, he can't afford right. to just be challenging hitters on the plate with it. Like, he needs other pitches working, other pitches being located for strikes in good areas of the zone in order to set the fastball up. So if he doesn't have that secondary stuff being commanded effectively, he's probably going to get hammered. So that's just his challenge, is having that consistent feel on the mound, that consistent release point, synced up with his mechanics. When I've seen him at his best, it's been in a really nice rhythm, really nice pace, really nice tempo. Some of that comes down to the catcher and how quickly they're getting the call to him and how they're managing him throughout the game. So it could be kind of hit and miss going forward with just, you know, how effective he is based on some of those factors.
Yeah. If he executes, he can be an effective pitcher. We've seen that. If he locates his pitches where he wants to locate them in the strike zone. So that upside exists. I think at the same time, and this applies to most pitchers, it applied to Spencer Schwalenbach on Tuesday. If you're missing with your location, then you could have really good stuff and you're still going to get hit. Or if you have, in the case of Easton Lucas, kind of ordinary stuff and you're not executing and you're not getting it to where you want it to go in the strike zone, or you're trying to throw a strike to ball and you leave it up over the plate, you can get into trouble pretty quickly. So there is vulnerability there. And again, the Jays are not alone in that. To have a fifth starter that, you know, you have some questions with, it's, yeah, they're not unique in that in Major League Baseball. But I think that this is, you know, now John Schneider was saying the other day that he's hopeful that the Blue Jays can have Max Scherzer back within the month. So, you know, by the middle of May. But a month, I mean, that's still a pretty significant chunk of the season where you're probably going to be relying on Easton Lucas or potentially an Eric Lauer or some sort of combination of pitchers that is not named Max Scherzer. And then even in a month, I mean, to me, that's a little bit aggressive just because Scherzer was never fully built up in the first place. And he's not throwing off a mound. He's throwing off flat ground right now. We all know the progression that has to happen. This is something that, you know, I'm not holding my breath as to that next time that Max Scherzer is going to take the mound.
Yeah, I'm pretty skeptical of that timeline, to be honest with you. Scherzer said himself, like, he wants this thumb issue to be zeroed out before he gets back on a mound and starts building up again. And as far as we know from Scherzer's reports and the Blue Jays reports, is he's still experiencing the symptoms in his thumb that were giving him problems. He's still experiencing that discomfort. And this is a guy who already had a cortisone shot, which was meant to treat the symptom. So evidently, just putting the pieces together, that hasn't been effective, or that hasn't done what the Blue Jays and Scherzer were hoping that it would do. If it had done what they were hoping it would do, he probably wouldn't be going off to see a second specialist right now, which is what he's doing. So he's getting another opinion on it. And I guess I don't know if another cortisone shot or a different treatment, something else conservative in the bag of tricks that can be applied to it, is going to be the result of that. I'm sure we'll probably learn more on Friday when the Blue Jays are back in action at Rogers Center. And we'll kind of see what sort of how the timeline evolves from there. But I mean, within a month, I'm not counting on that. I don't think the Max Scherzer will be back within a month. If he truly wants to be like feeling like himself and feeling healthy and feeling capable of going 80 to 100 pitches without having some sort of secondary issue crop up of this from this, whether it's a lat issue or a nerve issue or shoulder issue, some of the stuff that he's talked about in depth. If he truly wants to zero this out before he's back on a mound within a month is, I feel like from where I stand, somewhat unrealistic.
Yeah, it seems like that would be a great case scenario. If you could snap your fingers right now and you're the Blue Jays and you say, all right, it's May 16th, Scherzer's on the mound and he's stretched out, like you do that in a second. So, you know, I think that tells you it's probably a little bit on the optimistic side.
If I could, like, you know, bring Cy Young into the rotation, I'd snap my fingers and do that as well.
Well, absolutely.
Right? Like if Jim Palmer wanted to come in and make a start in peak form, let's do that.
Why don't we go back a couple months here? Because obviously, you know, knowing what we do now, like it doesn't look great. This Scherzer commitment of $15.5 million. Now, I have some thoughts on this deal, and the short version is I still think it's fine. But what do you think about this deal with hindsight, knowing now that he's pitched three innings, you know, for the first quarter of the season, you know, it could potentially be three innings that you get from Max Scherzer. Do you look at this deal any differently, knowing that the bulk and the health just have not been there for him?
I mean, knowing what we know now, you obviously would undo it.
Of course.
Yes. Everyone would. But knowing what you know at the time, I think the Blue Jays assessed the risk. They assessed the upside and they said, hey, like maybe we get the upside of, you know, 2023 Max Scherzer, who was a completely effective major league starter, like an above average big league starter. That was only a year prior to 24 when he had the issues, and the back issue is sorted out and resolved. You're not worried about that. I think the Blue Jays were aware of the thumb thing. They saw all the medicals from like Scherzer's entire history in the game. So they had all the information in front of them. So I think they made a bet with, hey, we're going to try to get this upside of, you know, one more really good year from a future Hall of Famer at the age of 40, understanding that there is definitely downside risk. And what we've seen materialize is the downside risk. You know, every free agent deal, every trade, every amateur drafting or signing is a bet, and there's risk involved in all of it. And, you know, when the Blue Jays signed Chris Bassitt to the 3-year deal that they signed him to in his mid 30s, you know, moving to, you know, when he had home run troubles, you know, in bigger ballparks, moving him to the Rogers Center, and, you know, with his stuff, which, you know, none of his pitches on their own grade out as plus in any kind of model, it's really just a bet on him being able to continue to mix and match and stay ahead of hitters and turn left when they're going right. And, you know, an ability to still be as durable as he's been earlier in his career as he gets into his late 30s. That was a bet too. And they ended up getting the upside with Bassitt, and we're seeing now the downside with Scherzer.
Yeah. The Bassitt deal, clearly a good deal. The Scherzer deal, the reason I think it's okay, I mean, clearly it's not great, but the reason that people say there's no such thing as a bad one-year deal is because the risk is kind of limited. And I also look at the bucket of pitchers who signed in that 1 year, you know, $10 to $15 million range this offseason, and it's just not great, right? You have Sugano, who came over. I mean, we've seen him face the Jays a couple times. Doesn't look great. Doesn't really have an out pitch. He was $13 million. Charlie Morton, he's off to a really rough start with the Orioles. He was $15 million. Justin Verlander, you know, some promising signs with San Francisco early, but certainly, you know, he's probably the best of the bunch, actually, and you'd definitely rather have Verlander than Scherzer, but I'm not sure that Verlander would have come here. So, you know, that's a good signing by San Francisco, it looks like. You've got Andrew Heaney. He's probably a good signing. That was $5 million bucks. But the point is, when you're shopping in that bucket, you're dealing with guys who have some sort of major question. You're spending $10 to $15 million on a starting pitcher. That pitcher has questions, whether it's performance, age, durability, whatever the case, you're not getting certainty there. So that's playing out right now for the Blue Jays, and they had hoped that this would be something better, but I can't honestly look at that deal and say, like, this is some bad deal.
What I, you know, might have done instead, and it still was on the table because he signed really late in the winter, would have been to go to 2 years, 36 for Jack Flaherty, if that would have bought him out of going to the Tigers, right? He went there for 2 years and 35. So,
yeah.
You know, if 236 or 238 would have gotten that done, and if I had budget room to do it, and if I, look, I don't know, you know, the Blue Jays, like how they project Flaherty or what they know about his medicals or how they think he would have fit in the clubhouse. Like, Scherzer comes with all these ancillary benefits as well that you can't really measure and that you can't put in a fridge. You know, all of these intangibles of how Bowden Francis has gotten better from him, and Chris Bassitt after every one of his starts. Chris Bassitt, by the way, the best pitcher in baseball right now, you know, singing Scherzer's praises and how much he's helping him. And every time we show the dugout on the broadcast, there's Scherzer like in Schneider's ear and in Pete's ear about strategy and about what's going on in the game. Even like just me from my privileged position beside the dugout for several of these games, I see Scherzer in there on the road at home, how active he is, talking to his teammates. Like, he is locked in on every single pitch. So all that stuff comes with it, and there is some sort of value to be put on that stuff. Not that I know how to really quantify that value, but I do think that Flaherty on a, you know, 2 year, $38 million deal probably would have been a better bet for health and performance than Scherzer on, you know, a year and $15 million. But the Blue Jays decided to go with the shorter term deal, and here they are.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think there definitely is some value to having Scherzer's wisdom and intensity in the dugout. I think also if teams put a really high premium on that knowledge and that intensity, then we would see coaches getting paid a lot more. And we would see former players a year or two done with their career getting huge salaries to be special advisors. And it's just not the case. So it seems to me that the industry doesn't necessarily value that knowledge on the scale of like millions and millions of dollars. So whatever the case, we'll see when Scherzer comes back. But I think as long as we're talking about pitcher contracts, probably makes sense to highlight Jimmy Garcia, absolutely dominant. And let's also talk about Jeff Hoffman, because you and I were there in Baltimore on the weekend when he pitched a two-inning, it wasn't a save, he actually got the win, but a two-inning performance to completely dominate the team that nearly signed him this offseason before backing away from the deal due to concerns over a physical that they didn't like with his shoulder. And then he blows a little kiss toward the Baltimore dugout afterwards, just reminding them. And I thought that was like an absolutely perfect way to show the Orioles up. No one's getting hurt with this. He's not throwing at anyone's head, but he is reminding them. And I loved that. I thought that intensity was awesome. And he backed it up with his performance, which has been kind of outrageous so far this season.
The one thing I'll say is, like, none of the Baltimore Orioles players had any say in that. Like, I'm sure they all wanted Jeff Hoffman on their teams. Like, is he blowing a kiss at the training staff or, yeah, right? Like, at the doctor who looked at the MRI and said, oh, have you guys seen this? Like, who is that kiss directed at? Because I'm sure that Gunnar Henderson, Natalie Rutschman would love to have Jeff Hoffman on their team.
Well, I mean, to be fair, what if like the team doctor was sitting above the Blue Jays dugout and then he has to like, what, kiss towards his own dugout? Or the guy sitting in left field or in a box? Like, I think symbolically it makes sense.
He's got to find Mike Elias up in, you know, the GM box, wherever he's at, right?
Right.
Like, I'm sure. I don't think that Ryan O'Hearn was like, you know, calling Elias this offseason being like, hey, have you seen his medicals?
Yeah, Ramon Laureano was a free agent at the time. It's not like he was, you know, saying that he shouldn't have signed. So, yeah, I mean, I think in a literal sense, it maybe doesn't add up. But I think when you look at the intent, I absolutely love it. You're not going to do that 162 times. Or if Hoffman pitches in 70 games, you're not going to do that 70 times. But picking your spots to remind the other team that you just shut them down completely, they couldn't touch you, I think it's great. It's great theater. It's great showmanship. We're here for entertainment. I want to be entertained. Like, you don't want to disrupt the flow of the game necessarily. You don't want to hurt anyone. But I thought that was perfect. I thought that was just great.
What I don't want to do is go to the two-inning well too often with Jeff Hoffman early in the season here. Like, I'm not going back to that for a while. He did it once all of last year, and he did it twice on the road trip in consecutive outings. And he was able to do it because he was so efficient in his first inning of those outings. But pitchers will tell you, like, it's not just the bulk of pitches, like the volume of pitches you throw. Like, it's the up-down. It's going into the dugout and sitting down for 10, 15, 17 minutes with your arm wrapped and trying to stay mentally locked in and engaged, and then going back out there and trying to like ramp the engine back up to like really high intensity explosive movements on the mound. That's a challenge, especially for like relievers who just aren't accustomed to that. Like relievers, especially closers, in their first inning of work, like they have to be airing it out. They can't be holding anything back saying, oh, well, if I'm back out for a second inning, like maybe I'll only throw this splitter 90%. They have to be throwing everything 98-99. So it's really impressive that Hoffman was able to do that and evidently felt no ill effects of it. But I would be cautious with that if I'm the Blue Jays. I understand the urgency to win games now, particularly these divisional games, but Hoffman's importance to this bullpen is rather evident for everyone to see. So I'm going to be cautious with the usage going forward, even if, you know, he is my best option for the 10th inning in a game later this month. I don't want to go to that well too often and end up paying a really dire price.
Man, you're riding that razor's edge with it, though, because the last thing that you want to do is not use him enough or lose a game because you went to Chad Green, who doesn't look great, by the way, and you go to Chad Green because you don't want to use, let's say you don't want to use Hoffman on back-to-back nights, or you don't want to use him 3 out of 4, and then you turn to Mason Fluharty for 2 more extra outs than you should have. Like, it's a balance, and I totally agree with you. They need to throttle back on Hoffman. That's, I think, not really up for debate. And certainly John Schneider's aware of that. Because at this point, set aside the innings, but at this point, if you just look at the games, the percentage of the Blue Jays games in which he has appeared, he would be on a pace to pitch in 77 games. And you just can't do that. It's got to be more like 65, maybe 70. If you want to have him available and rested and ready for what would presumably be a very long playoff run if you're going to have the season go the way you want it to. And if you're in a wild card series, set aside the ALCS because that's so far away. If you want to get in a wild card series, guess who's pitching both of those games? Jeff Hoffman and Jimmy Garcia. So you need them. You can't just get there and have them be going on fumes.
And guess who might be getting 5, 6, 7 outs across multiple innings in each of those games?
Yes.
Like that's when you're redlining it. Like that's when you're going to the well. To be doing it this early, I think that, you know, if you want to avoid some sort of a midseason IL stint or you want to avoid someone being burned out at the end of the year, you're going to want to be cautious with that. But like, I understand the temptation to do it because like these early season games are against really good opponents. You know, in the case of the Red Sox and Orioles, they're interdivisional games. So like every win is sort of like two because you're dealing a loss to a team that you're going to be battling with directly for postseason positioning down the stretch. So, you know, those are big wins to get. And when you look at the way that Hoffman has performed, like you look at the composure and the intent, and like put aside the fact that he throws 3+ pitches that all look the same out of his hand, and all look like fastballs halfway to the plate and then move in different directions at slightly different speeds, the tunneling, like the lanes that he works with, just the aggressiveness in the zone, like, yeah, who wouldn't want to throw that repeatedly? I mean, he's fearless. Like he's all those qualities and characteristics that you want in a closer, like he has it. There's no sense of trepidation on the mound. Like he controls every appearance so well. And this is a guy who wasn't a full-time closer last year. He had some opportunities, but like this is his first year as a full-time closer and he looks the part right out of the gate. So I totally understand what, you know, considering the options that John Schneider and Pete Walker are dealing with some nights, going back to him for that second inning. But look, they've gotten away with it 2 times. I'm not sure we're going to see it again for another couple of weeks.
I got to admit, I'd be open to doing it more. I'm not saying all the time. I totally agree you got to throttle back, but you also want to win games. And Jeff Hoffman is obviously the best pitcher on the Blue Jays inning for inning. That is clear. But beyond that, he, to me, is one of the most dominant pitchers in baseball right now. When you alluded to the splitter, the slider, the fastball, this guy is dominant. And I think inning for inning, it would be hard for me to come up with a long list of names that are better inning for inning than Jeff Hoffman. So, oh man, it is tempting. That's an arm you want on the mound to the extent that you can keep him healthy.
Strike 3 called. What a job by Jeff Hoffman, and what a comeback here today for the Blue Jays, finding a way to win this game.
Absolutely. And everybody.
Anything else on the pitching side before we take a break?
I mean, Chris Bassett's like the best pitcher in baseball. He's halfway to pitcher of the month, very quietly.
He's been great.
It's like unbelievable. He has like started this year so well. And there were some questions coming off of the second half that he had last year. So like kudos to him. Kudos to Brendan Little for the like ridiculous whiff rate and the amount of swing and miss that he's getting and the start to the season that he's having. I mean, that's a guy who hasn't exactly been a shutdown leverage reliever before in his career. And the Blue Jays like put a lot of pressure on him this year and had a lot of confidence in him saying, hey, you're our number one lefty. Like you are the dude. And I mean, he has inherited that role and been really, really good in it. And you know, I mean, just the starting pitching in general, when you know, Gausman, Bassett, Berríos, like all these guys have looked good outside of opening day with Berríos and, you know, Bowden Francis outside of a couple of hiccups, like they've been really solid. Like that is still the bedrock of this team. Like that is still where everything starts. That's why they are 11-8 or whatever it is, because their starting pitching has been that good and has allowed them to scrape across some of these like nip and tuck tight one run games that they've won to this point. How sustainable is that without hitting more homers? Not particularly, but for now it's working.
Yeah, it looks really good when you have Chris Bassett going out there pitching the way he has, striking out all kinds of guys. I mean, that is impressive.
2-2. He got him. Bassett pitches out of it. Strands a couple. He's got 10 strikeouts already.
I don't necessarily expect it to continue at this rate, but look, it is a great sign for the rest of this season. that he would be pitching this well now, because he has a lot of room to, you know, miss location a little bit more, or, you know, not be quite as pinpoint with his command and still be a really, really good pitcher who can absorb a lot of innings, who can get some big outs and avoid barrels. So that's huge for the Jays. Then you surround that with, like you said, some performances from less heralded players like a Brendan Little, and you get to be in a good spot as a pitching staff. You know, we saw them on Wednesday. They set a franchise record with 19 strikeouts in a single game. I mean, that's the Atlanta offense is not cooking right now the way that they can, but you're still talking about some really good hitters there, whether it's Matt Olson or Austin Riley or Ozzie Albies. Like, this lineup could still hit, and the Blue Jays completely dominated them. So that's a really good sign that they've been able to get those strikeouts and you know, those innings from guys like Bassett.
Yeah, Atlanta, I understand, is off to a rough start, but that's a team like the Astros last year where we're going to look up in June or July and they're going to be in playoff position because they just have that much talent.
Well, once they get Acuna back too, like they played the first few weeks without Strider. He's still trying to find his footing. Then they'll get Acuna back. Like, that's still a really good team. So credit to the Blue Jays for their series win there. But there are still some questions on the offensive side of things, and we will explore some of those when we return on At the Letters. Welcome back to At the Letters. And as we were recording the first half of this podcast, the Blue Jays passed along a little bit of news that actually ties in very nicely to our second segment here. And that is the news that Davis Schneider has been optioned to AAA. And presumably the corresponding move will be Nathan Lucas coming back from the paternity list. That will then join him with the likes of Addison Barger, Tyler Heineman, Ernie Clement on the Blue Jays bench. So, Arden, initial thoughts on Davis Schneider? I mean, we know he hasn't really performed in a while now, but I certainly for some fans, when you go back to the debut that he had and the kind of fanfare that surrounded him in 2023, this could be a little bit surprising for some people.
Yeah, but that was a long time ago, 2023. We are in April in 2025, and you don't want to judge too harshly for a guy who had 21 plate appearances on the season. I mean, that's the fewest on the Blue Jays, aside from Addison Barger, who's been up for two whole games. So it's not like Davis has had an opportunity to get into a rhythm or to see a ton of live pitching consistently, but he also hasn't earned those opportunities. Like, you can't argue against this move on merit. You can't argue against it on just aesthetically how he looked at the plate, what kind of a threat he seemed to be in the box. He hasn't barreled a ball all year. And his, like, to me, when I just kind of watched him at the plate, it looked like he was trying to walk a lot.
Yes.
And like, I think that shows up in his swing rate, which is down to 30% this year, which is like Vogelbachian. You know, like, you just don't see guys at this level swinging only 30% of the time. And was he jobbed on some bad calls from time to time? Yes, absolutely. Has a big adjustment that he's needed to make, been laying off of pitches in areas where he was chasing and expanding and getting into trouble? Yes, but that means you also still need to be aggressive and in attack mode and barreling the pitches that you can drive when you do get them. And so I think there just wasn't enough aggressiveness and intent, wasn't enough contact, wasn't enough hard contact. So I think the best thing for the Blue Jays and for Davis, honestly, is that he goes to AAA, sorts some of this stuff out, gets his head in a better place, starts seeing some better results, and maybe comes back up and is a factor later this year.
Well, you think about what role he's occupying on the Blue Jays roster, and the role is to be basically a corner bat, not a defensive player, right? They have Miles Straw for that. By the way, Miles Straw carrying this offense. Him and Tyler Heineman just carrying this offense with incredible
and George
bench. Right, and George Springer.
Fan favorite, spring training breakout, George Springer.
That's right.
Springer lifts one left center field. Well hit. And gone! Springer has hit it out. his second of the season, and the Blue Jays have the first run of the ball game.
Boy, is he swinging.
Well, Straw and Heinemann are doing their part. They need other complementary players to do theirs. And the role that Davis Schneider has been occupying has been essentially the role that you might have an Adam Duvall or a JD Martinez fill. Like, it's to be a slugger because he's not there for his defense. He's not there for his base running. He is not there to hit right-handed pitching. He is there to hit left-handed pitching and destroy it. And the Blue Jays have been putting into those positions, not a ton of them. It's still early, but they put him into those spots and he didn't do it. And he didn't really seem close to doing it. So doesn't mean he can't do it again. We've seen him do it. But at this point in time, it's not happening. I think this move makes a lot of sense. He was not inspiring fear into other teams. We even saw the Orioles over the weekend. They could have flipped the matchup to have a Will Wagner or Alan Roden pinch hit against a right-handed pitcher. They stuck with the lefty against Davis Schneider. That gives you an indication as to what they thought of his ability to do damage against their pitching.
Not only that, but like a struggling and ineffective Gregory Soto, they left him in over Yennier Cano, who's been lights out and who, as we had seen in that series, was just in much better current form than Soto. They preferred the matchup of an ineffective Soto versus Schneider versus over Cano, who has been really good this year, versus it was like Alan Roden, rookie who's never seen Cano before and who also isn't having a great start to the season with the bat. They actually preferred the former matchup. So I think that, you know, the opponents are telling you, you know, all that you need to know. I just think that Davis needs to get back to being a bit more aggressive. Like, I just think that he needs to get back to having a bit more intent at the plate. Like, I don't know if you were seeing some of the same things I was seeing, but he just looked a little too cautious and hesitant to me.
Absolutely, I was seeing that. And I think that's 100% true. The walk in the finale at Fenway Park, he was jobbed of a couple pitches there that the calls went against him, calls went against the whole team that day, as a matter of fact. But it still seemed like he was trying to walk. And that wasn't the only time I saw that. And walks are a part of his game. They can't be the whole thing. And we just didn't see enough barrels. So the other thing is, he was great at AAA and he was great in the major leagues when there wasn't a scouting report on him. But there's now a scouting report on him, and there are just fewer mistakes made in the major leagues. Pitchers are better with their command. They are not as likely to leave a hanging breaking ball over the plate. They're not as likely to put a fastball 92 miles an hour middle. So he's going to have to make some adjustments and really capitalize on the one or two mistakes per game that he gets. And it's not easy. Major League Baseball is obviously as tough as it gets. So not easy, but I think that's the right call for the Jays to send him down.
And it's a hard role for a like non-vet to fill. Like, that's why you usually see the Vogelbachs or the Robbie Grossmans in that role, or the Adam
Justin
Duvalls,
Turner,
right? As you mentioned. Yeah. It's a veteran role, because those are guys who are okay with sitting on the bench for 3 days and then coming into a huge pinch hit spot cold, having only like faced a traject machine for 72 hours. Those are guys who just have like a really defined approach and a really good idea of what they're doing at the plate and how to get to the pitch that they need to get to, and then not miss it and execute on it when they do get to it. So, for a 26-year-old who has only been in the big leagues for a couple of seasons, I think it's harder just to thrive in that role than it is for a vet who's been doing it for a very long time.
You mentioned Alan Roden in passing earlier, and I do want to give him some credit too, as long as we're talking about young players on this Blue Jays roster and guys who are not necessarily in there every day. Because I think with Roden, we're talking about someone where the quality of his at-bats has actually been very, very good, and you're not seeing him give any at-bats away. He's composed from pitch to pitch. He seemingly goes up there with a plan, has been able to execute it, and even, you know, facing Schwellenbach on Tuesday, had a couple of great at-bats where, one, he's able to take a fastball the opposite way for a double that he barreled up. And then later he connects for his first major league home run in that same game. So starting to see some real flashes of the big swing from Alan Roden.
He's swinging away here, and he has hit it out. His first major league home run. What a moment for Alan Roden. A two-run shot.
Almost what I like just as much as that is that we're seeing he finds ways to produce with his base running too, which is defense too. We're seeing him contribute in various facets of the game, even when he's not putting together that big swing. So that to me is actually really encouraging when you look at his possible contributions to this team.
Yes, that is encouraging in a like two plate appearance sample, and it needs to continue because up until then, the contact quality had been really unimpressive from Roden.
But the AB quality was high, though.
I agree. He works a very strong plate appearance. He doesn't whiff. He doesn't strike out. We know this about him. He's got great hand-eye and bat-to-ball. He sees pitches. He's obviously very intelligent and has a plan. But to hang around at this level, like the swing just has to produce more damage potential than it has been for Roden. Like even with those two balls that he barreled the other day, we're talking about a 2.4% barrel rate this year.
Right.
That is the second lowest on the team to, oh my goodness, Alejandro Kirk. That's not what you want to see. But like, hey, you know, a 31% hard hit rate. You know, he's got a 388 slug this year, but his expected slug is 275 because the contact quality just hasn't been good enough. So if he can continue to like get to the contact quality that he showed you with those two swings, then yes, like that's a big leaguer right there. And hopefully the plate approach and some of the, you know, the soft skill plate appearance stuff that you're talking about, hopefully that carries him through until he finds a way to barrel more baseballs.
Yeah. And I think we're seeing that he is doing that. And I don't want to forget too, that this is the first 18 games of his major league career. So I am really looking at this through a positive light here and seeing a guy who is helping this team win. His defense has been really steady. His base running has been really good. He's getting good reads. He was able to score on a really close play the other day in one of the Atlanta games. So I'm liking what I'm seeing from his overall game. And of course, it's going to look better if he can barrel the ball more, if he can put more balls in the seats. But, you know, to see him kind of hold his own against the best pitchers in the world, he's faced Edwin Diaz, he's faced Schwellenbach, he's faced Strider, some of the elite pitchers in this game, and he's still finding ways to produce at an above league average level. So for me, when I look at this performance, even, you know, obviously, you know, the big swings are the big swings, but even setting that aside, I don't think he's the last guy on this roster. Like I think he's finding ways to really make himself a part of this team.
Yeah, I just think that what the Blue Jays are lacking right now is damage and is slug. And he hasn't really been holding up that end of the bargain. Like there's a lot of guys on this roster, whether it's like a Will Wagner or an Andrés Giménez, who's quietly got a double digit walk rate, even like a Miles Straw in some of his like grit my teeth and battle plate appearances, just try to make contact. Like the plate appearances where he goes from, all right, it's a safety squeeze first pitch to swing away second pitch to make sure you put this in play to the right side third pitch. There's, you know, and Tyler Heineman in this category as well. Like a lot of guys who are just trying to give you a good plate appearance and make pitch throw pitches and make contact and like not be an empty calorie out. I think that in Roden's position, you'd like to see some more damage. And I think that if Addison Barger is able to take on some of Davis Schneider's playing time, although obviously like it's not an easy fit because Schneider was the righty facing lefties and, you know, Addison Barger is a left-handed hitter. So we'll see how these puzzle pieces fit. But if Barger starts like putting some balls in play at a high rate of speed, he could potentially start eating into some of Alan Roden's playing time in the corner outfield spots because the Blue Jays just need more slug up and down their lineup right now.
Yeah, look, if Barger goes off, then anything's possible. And if he finds his inner Ryan O'Hearn or his inner Matt Wallner and he can kind of become that for the Blue Jays, then that would be really good. In the meantime, very content with what I'm seeing from Alan Roden. I think there are bigger questions elsewhere on this team. And on that list, I'll point to Will Wagner right now. And, you know, this is another young player, another left-handed hitter, someone who is really promising, of course, and still is promising. But when I look at Will Wagner, I'm going to set aside the offense right now because it is such a small sample. But I don't like what I'm seeing defensively from him at third base. I don't see a major league third baseman right now. And that is not to say that he can't become one. And that's not to say that he can't become one this season, perhaps, because players can develop and learn quickly. But his throws are too tentative. His hands have not been good. And the speed of the game sometimes seems to just go a little quick on him. So the things I'm looking for at third base, I'm not seeing from Will Wagner. And I think that's got to be a concern. I asked John Schneider about this yesterday, and he was obviously very political about it and didn't want to say anything bad about Will Wagner, but he wasn't exactly showering praise on him either, because you can't. The way he's been playing, it's just he does. I mean, I don't know if you see it differently. We haven't talked about this yet, but I see him getting a little overmatched defensively.
Yeah, I think that if Ernie Clement was off to a better start offensively, you would likely see more Ernie at third. We saw him playing there every day last year. Right now, it's been, you know, basically a platoon between those two, because neither guy's really separated themselves offensively. Like, who do you think has the higher batting average between the two?
I would guess Ernie.
They're tied at 186.
Oh, boy.
Who do you think has the higher slugging percentage between the two?
Oh, Wagner?
They're tied at 233. So okay. They have played to an exact tie offensively. And I think that they are obviously very different hitters. Like, Clement is a contact specialist. Wagner is going to work a much more patient, discerning, less aggressive plate appearance. And like, that's why you see the difference in, the on base, and you see a difference in the walk rate for Wagner being much higher. You see a difference in the contact rate for Clement being much higher. I mean, Will Wagner's seeing 4.46 pitches per plate appearance, which is first on the Blue Jays. Ernie Clement's seeing 3.16, which is last on the Blue Jays. So they're like such different hitters. Like, they have such a different styles and characteristics, but in this fascinating way, they have both played to identical batting averages and slugging percentages. So I think that, like, unless Wagner's defense is an absolute liability and it's like, this guy's costing us 3 runs per game, which I don't think it has been.
We've but seen that's impossible. Some, that's you. That wouldn't be possible.
I was obviously exaggerating, but like, I'm saying, like, unless he was like actively losing you games, we've seen him make good plays. We've seen the defense be inconsistent. I think there's a belief that with the athlete that he is and some of the baseball IQ that he has, that there is a better defender in there than we've seen at times. Obviously, Ernie is the better, more consistent defender, but I think that the bat is what gets you in the lineup, particularly if you're, you know, on days when it's like Andrés Giménez and Miles Straw and Alejandro Kirk are all starting, and those have all been kind of defense first players at the moment. So I think that, you know, until somebody separates themselves with the bat, I think you'll continue to see those two splitting playing time.
Yeah. If I was the Jays, I would be playing Ernie Clement and Addison Barger, maybe a little bit of Addison Barger, maybe a little bit of Will Wagner, but I wouldn't be playing Will Wagner there a lot. I would keep working him out there, and I would keep trying to find ways to get him better there, have him work with Carlos Fables, have him try to, you know, do everything he can behind the scenes. But I don't think he's helping them right now with that third base defense. The throws just look too tentative.
But he's helping them more on the offensive side.
Well, I'm not saying take him out of the lineup. You can DH him. You can play him at first base when Vlad Jr. DHs. You can pinch hit him. So there are ways to get him in the lineup. I'm not saying he's not a major league player, but I'm specifically talking about his defense right now and his defense at third base, which is, you know, part of the one of the places he fits now that the Blue Jays have Andrés Giménez. I'm open-minded. I'm not saying that this can't change, but right now it's not good.
I just don't think you have the opportunity at DH right now, because Anthony Santander is like slowly becoming a full-time DH, because you want to talk about shaky defense. Anthony Santander in an outfield corner is not looking great. And, you know, Dalton Varsho is on his way back, which is going to shake up some of the outfield playing time. And of the Blue Jays' last 6 games, Santander has started at DH in 5 of them. And you still need DH playing time for George Springer and for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And there's going to be a day when Bo Bichette is off of his feet. And there's going to be a day when, somebody takes a foul ball and, you know, can't play the field but can hit. So you need the DH spot for that. I just don't know that you have that DH playing time consistently for Will Wagner right now. And I do think that he is still bringing you something offensively. Like, this is like their 5-6 hitter a lot of days. You know, think about it that way, right? Like, there's four guys below him in the lineup. So, and if the Blue Jays had a better option to hit fifth, then they would be penciling that person in there. So right now I'm trying to push offense into this lineup as much as I can because my pitching has been really good. My run prevention has been pretty good so far. I need to create more runs. So Will Wagner gives me a better opportunity to do that than some of the other options.
Well, I agree with you in identifying the need for offense. I am not necessarily sold that Will Wagner is that solution at a time that he has a 518 OPS. And yeah, he's taking, you know, long at bats, but that in itself doesn't necessarily put runs on the board. So this is where, look, you want to try a left-handed hitter at third base. I'm open to the Addison Barger idea. Like, you could try him there and see if you can catch lightning in a bottle, see if he can give you some damage there. But, you know, I don't think Will Wagner, as at present, is the Blue Jays' fifth or sixth best hitter. So I don't think you need to force him into the lineup, is what I'm saying.
So it's a huge benefit when Alan Roden has these really strong plate appearances, but not so much when Will Wagner does it, is what you're saying.
Look.
It's
not inconsistent, man. Will Wagner has a 518 OPS. Alan Roden has a 739. That's a big difference. We're seeing results that are better from Alan Roden, and that's even before his first game. So, you know, I don't think it's inconsistent at all. I think that if Will Wagner had a 739 OPS, I would be saying that he should be in there, but I'm not seeing the underlying barrels. I'm not trying to pick on Will Wagner, but you're saying he's their fifth or sixth best hitter. I'm just not there.
I mean, Wagner has a higher barrel rate than Roden. He has in terms of process, I agree with you, results haven't necessarily been there in the way they have been for Roden. But in terms of process, Wagner's got a 282 expected weighted on base. Roden's got a 256. So Wagner has been better in terms of process. We're majoring in the minors here, obviously, yeah. And it's not going to make a huge difference which one of these guys is in the lineup four times and which one of them is in the lineup three times. I agree with you that I'd like to see Addison Barger at third base because I think that's a more natural position for him than corner outfield. It sounds like the Blue Jays see Barger as more of a corner outfielder right now, which is kind of interesting because you look at the huge arm and you look at some of the athleticism that Barger clearly has. I mean, this is a guy who's played shortstop coming up through the minors. I think he would be a great fit as a third baseman, but I wouldn't be surprised if we mostly see him in the outfield going forward.
Yeah, and that's how the Blue Jays have talked about him this spring. I do wonder at a certain point if that shifts back, because if you have Miles Straw performing, you know, at the level that he has, and you have Springer, of course, Varsho coming back, he could be back, you know, should be back, I would think, at some point this month. We'll see exactly when that is, but potentially 10 days away, something like that. So then you have him in the mix. You have Santander in the mix. You have Roden in the mix. Outfield starts to get pretty crowded. So it could flip back to the point where Barger is most useful to you in an infield role.
I think the best case scenario, Addison Barger shows up and does some of the stuff that he was doing in the minors, which was like just barreling the baseball. And also, like, the results weren't necessarily there for Barger in the minors. And, you know, part of that is it's super cold playing for Buffalo right now. But like, he was, you know, at a spot where like he had the most balls hit 110 plus at AAA before he came up. That's like premium elite exit velo. So if he can come up and start barreling some balls like that's something that neither Roden nor Wagner are doing consistently. We can at least agree on that. While, you know, we're not like, yes, like Wagner does have a slight edge on Roden and, you know, basically all the hard hit stuff. Like, neither of them are like, oh my God, we need to force this guy into the lineup, right? We're talking about a Wagner 3% barrel rate versus a Roden 2.4%, right? It's, you know, it's a tomato a little bit. So I think that if Barger shows up and starts barreling baseballs, then he's going to see a bunch more playing time, because that's just the biggest thing that the Blue Jays need out of their lineup right now. Like, how long can they consistently outperform their lack of slug? Like, how long can they keep winning these games where they're scratching runs across and they're playing small ball and bunting and hitting and running and ground balls to the right side and like all this stuff that we love, right? Like all this baseball stuff that's cool and great and won a bunch of games in the 80s. In 2025, like, you just need to hit more home runs. If the Blue Jays don't find a way to get more home runs, the way they're winning right now just is not going to be sustainable.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's great that Miles Straw and Tyler Heineman have put the offense on their backs. It really is, but not a recipe that you're going to expect to continue to work. So they need some of their big boppers to start hitting for more power. We did see the beginnings of that with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. finally hitting his first home run in the 19th game of the season. Bo Bichette still looking for that first one. Santander has a couple. We talked about this last week, but just to kind of reset here, what's your level of concern slash optimism for where this team is at from a home run hitting standpoint?
I'm not concerned about any of those three, honestly. Like, it's so early in the year. Like, you got to take the results out and look at the process stuff. And, you know, just in terms of barrel rate, hard hit rate, we're definitely seeing that from Vlad and Bo. Like, they're just making amazing contact. If Bo keeps having the quality of contact that he's had to this point, he's going to be like a top 20 hitter by season's end. Like, he could be getting down valid MVP votes. He's been extremely unlucky to this point. He has some like a 200 point gap between his expected slugging and his actual slugging. And, you know, same could be said for his expected WOBA and his actual weighted on base average. And these are some of the biggest gaps in baseball. So, like, remember the one that Rafaela took away from him in Boston with like just an absurd play that, like, I'm not even sure that Dalton Varsho makes that play. Like, and there's been a couple of Dylan Cruz robbed them of one at Rogers Center when they were playing Washington. Tyler O'Neill took one away from him opening weekend. Like, he's just hitting some very, very, very loud outs. So I think if Bo keeps doing what he's doing, like, he's going to have a monster year. Same goes for Vlad. He's got the best barrel rate on the team. Like, the hard hit is up over 50%. I think that he just, you know, once he sorts out some of the sweet spot stuff, the launch angle stuff, gets a bit more lucky on the fly balls that he's hitting, I think his number is going to look like Vlad. And then with Santander, like, it's hard to know with this guy after, you know, in April, because historically, like, every April is just disastrous for him. Like, it's just what he's done every single season of his career for one reason or another. Blue Jays tried to address it a little bit in spring training by working on some bat speed stuff and some aggressiveness stuff, and it hasn't quite paid off. Like, for one reason or another, this is just a guy who gets out to slow starts. But I mean, last June he hit like 13 homers or something crazy, you know? Like, he's liable to go off in the summer and hit like 25 homers between July and August. So until I see Santander's skid bleeding into the summer months, I'm not really going to be concerned about it.
Yeah, I'm not concerned about him. Vlad, Bo, they look good. Bo, he's not really a 40 homer hitter anyway. So for him to go a couple weeks where he's hitting zero instead of, you know, two home runs, it's not a huge difference. So I think Vlad and Bo look good. I'm not concerned. I do think that a picture is emerging for me of this Blue Jays offense, though. And I would say that, you know, going into the year, I thought they had a chance to be a pretty good offense. And I actually still believe that. And so far this year, their OPS plus as a team is above average, 106. You look at their WRC plus, it's been hovering around the, you know, 10th in baseball range, which that's obviously good. You can win and succeed with an offense that good. I think the shape of it will change a little as Heinemann regresses and Straw regresses, but Vlad and Bo and Santander find the seats a little bit more often. Who knows what happens with some of those younger players? Maybe you know, someone like Clement takes a step forward, or someone like Barger can do some good things at the plate as well. So overall, I think this can be a good offense. I don't think that they're going to be a good home run offense when I look at the personnel on this team, and just getting a little bit more information about them 10% of the way into the season. I think the picture that's emerging for me is good offensive team, but not good home run hitting team. And obviously, the most important part is to be a good offensive team. And how you get there is kind of secondary. Obviously, there are certain things that play a bit better in the playoffs, but get there first, and having a good offense is essential to getting there. And I think the Jays can have a good offense here.
Yeah, it feels like the conversation we've had the last couple of years, where the Blue Jays have been like these high contact, high walk rate, low strikeout rate, you know, chippy plate appearance teams that end up with like weighted runs created plus of 105, but that isn't converting into wins as often as it needs to. And maybe this year it will. And it does seem like this has been the design or the intended outcome for a few years now is we're going to pitch really, really well. We're going to defend really, really well. Like, we're going to prevent runs at a, you know, top 10 rate. And we're going to field an offense that wears on opposing pitching staffs and sees a bunch of pitches and makes good swing decisions, has low chase rates, takes its walks, doesn't strike out a whole bunch, puts the ball in play, forces things, but doesn't necessarily lead the league in home runs. Like, you look at the Blue Jays offense that everyone hated last year. That was a 101 weighted runs created plus offense. So that was 1% above league average. Like, that was in the top half of the league. And yet, if you just thought about the Blue Jays offense from 2024 in your head, you would think it was ineffective. So
yeah,
we'll see if they can get more runs out of this approach this year. But yeah, like, look, you look to Vlad and Santander for like 30, 35 homers. You look to Bo for 20, 25. And you're hoping for like 10 to 15 from like George and Kirk, and maybe
a little more from Springer. They've told him they want him to get his A swing off, and you know, he hit 19 last year. I think Springer is like 15 to 20.
Sure, maybe Jimenez closer to 10, Kirk closer to 15, yeah, something like that. And then you take whatever you can get out of like a Wagner, a Roden, a Barger, and no longer a Davis Schneider. Ernie could maybe get to 10, but yeah, you're not gonna, like, I don't see 180 homers on this team.
Yeah, I don't know what the total would be, but it's not an offense that's built around home runs. So look, I mean, at the trade deadline, you have a chance to maybe add there a little bit if they remain in contention. Clearly, right-handed bat is a need for this team. They don't have one. They don't have that bench bat. So that's one area. You look at Easton Lucas, fifth starter, that's an area. Although Manoah is, of course, rehabbing, and you hope that some internal options emerge. And then second lefty, you know, relief help always on the radar for teams in contention. So there are lots and lots of ways to improve this roster. There are players at the bottom of this roster that could definitely be improved upon. That's a long way off. But in the meantime, I think that this is more of a solid offense, and they need the pitching to keep maybe not going at this level, but they need the pitching to be there because it doesn't look like an offense that's totally going to overpower people.
I chose that number 180 because that's what it took to get you into the top half of the league last season. The Colorado Rockies finished 15th with 179 last season. Blue Jays finished 26th with 156 last season. So if you want to be like top half of the league in terms of home runs, if it's going to go like it did last year, you want to be around 180. I don't necessarily see that without something we're not expecting, or as you said, like a trade or somebody emerging from the minor leagues to add a bunch of thump to this roster. But I just don't think I don't think it's the way they're built, right?
No, like,
I just,
it's, and look, let's be real. No one's coming from the minor leagues to save this offense, right?
Well, Addison Barger's here, man. Here we go.
Well,
Josh Donaldson 2.0.
Nick Kurtz is not sitting at AAA Buffalo. Like, no one is sitting. No one is going to come and just like salvage this. Like, Jonathan Class A, if he comes up, he might hit two home runs. Like, which is fine. It's not to say that they don't have viable options, but this offense, they can be above average. But yeah, the more you look at it, it's like, the home runs are not going to be the driving force of it. Which, hey, that's one tool to score runs. It's the best tool, but it's just one tool. So they have to use the other tools, whether it's singles, doubles, walks, stolen bases, whatever they can do to get runs across the plate. And so far, it's actually been working okay.
Yeah, I mean, Aurelvis is the one guy you'd look at who could like really impact things from a power perspective in the big leagues this year. He's off to a really tough start at AAA. It appears he is not loving the conditions that the Bisons have been playing in for the first stretch of the season, which have been quite challenging. Playing baseball outdoors in Buffalo, not great.
His OPS is 366. I don't think he's saving them.
Yeah, like I just said, he's not off to a great start. But if I'm trying to identify somebody in the minors who has a ton of power potential and could add pop to this lineup, it's him and Barger, right?
Yeah.
You said there was no one. I think that Aurelvis could. I mean, this is a guy who had as many home runs as anybody in the minor leagues over like the last 5 years.
Yeah. No, you're right. Aurelvis has pop, and you never know. He could go off and he could lead the team for a month in home runs at the major league level. I mean, that would be great if that could happen.
Could you not see like a Babe Schneider arc from him in July? Yeah. Right? He gets called up at Fenway Park and he goes off and hits like 10 homers in a month.
I mean, it is within his skill set for something like that to happen. But you can't ever sit here and bank on that. The guys you can bank on are in the major leagues for a reason. And you can hope on something like that, but you cannot bank on it.
I am banking on Anthony Santander coming around in like a really big way and having like a 2-week hot streak in May or June where he's just like electric, where it's like one of those Lourdes Gurriel Jr. streaks where the guy just everything the guy's bat touches just explodes over outfield walls. Since 2021, in the month of April and any games at the end of March that are included there at the beginning of the season, the guy's hitting .208 with a .657 OPS and 11 homers. That's since 2021. There are over 200 players that have made at least 250 March-April plate appearances since 2021, and Santander's batting average ranks within the bottom 10%. So, like, this is something that happens with the guy. Like, last year, it actually extended into May. Like, last year, he entered June hitting, like, .211 with a .712 OPS, and then he went bananas in June and hit 13 homers in the month of June. He hit 8 more in July. Like, his OPS through over June and July, over 53 games, was .973. So, like, he's liable to get hot in a real hurry. I heard a funny story the other day. Like, it was right around this time last year when he was hitting, like, .180 as he, you know, is now. And he had, like, an 0-for-4 night and just, like, mess around with his agent because, like, it's a walk year. It's a free agency year. So, like, people are kind of on edge. Like, hey, you got to put up some numbers. And he called his agent after a game and he was like, hey, man, I know we're in a free agent year. Are you getting nervous? And his agent was like, maybe. And Santander was like, because I'm not. And that just like summed up like how he was carrying himself. He's in this like epic slump to start the year, really, really important year with all this stuff on the line. And he was just like totally confident and totally relaxed and assured. And I think you talk to Blue Jays people right now and behind the scenes, they'll tell you like he's been, Santander's been as steady as they can be. You'd think he was hitting .400.
Absolutely. And you could tell it was a relief for him to hit his first of the season in Baltimore. Where he hit so many home runs, of course. But you look at just who he has been for such a long time against the best pitchers in the world, full confidence that he'll be able to hit, you know, whatever it is, 25 to 35 home runs somewhere in there. Not expecting 44 again, but I don't think anyone is. So he should be able to contribute, and that will give them at least a little more power than they've had because they need a little more. I think they can get a little more power.
Yeah, they're going to need it, man. I mean, this the way they're winning, it's you take it, you take these runs, you bank them, you run, you don't look back, but eventually they're going to need to start slugging the ball if they want to continue winning.
That's for sure. All right, well, we will continue to follow all of the developments offensively on the pitching side, on the trade market, in the minor leagues, whatever the case here on At The Letters. So stay with us as the season develops. But for today, that is going to be it. Thank you to Arden Zwelling. Thank you to Christian Ryan for putting this together. And thanks to you for listening to this week's edition of At The Letters.